I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
On today's episode, Tom Gleason and Ben Elwood join me to tackle the 5 pressing questions I needed answers to. My name is Justin Hamilton, and you're listening hard to Big Squid. For joining me today. It was great to have Tom Gleason here in Sydney. He was only here for a little while, and I took this as an opportunity not only to catch up with him, but bring in our pal Ben Elwood. It was a fun chat. It's a stupid chat. It's not always stupid. Sometimes it's actually quite insightful. But, you know, there's some stupid parts to it. And if you're wondering what's going on, wasn't there a podcast yesterday? Maybe you missed the announcement. I'm doing 3 separate editions of Big Squid this week. So yesterday's episode had Rove and I discussing the latest episode of Loki. And tomorrow's episode will just be me covering the second to last episode of season 2 of The Leftovers. It's a big week of podcasting, and I hope that it isn't too much me in your life. For this podcast, I had 5 questions that I threw at Tom and Ben, and right from the get-go, both of my guests are in fine form. I won't tell you the questions. I'll let you hear them so you can hear their reaction in real time. I'm going to be honest. There was one question that didn't quite get the response I wanted. I won't tell you which one. I'll save it for the end of the podcast. I reckon you'll work out what it is. Anyway, let's get into it, and welcome to the stage, Tom Gleason and Ben Elwood. So we're at Shay J, as I like to call it. We have the star of Hard Quiz, Tom Gleason, and we have someone who I'm guessing has never seen Hard Quiz.
I actually have seen a lot of Hard Quiz. I've been watching a lot of Hard Quiz recently.
Well, it's very popular, so it makes sense.
I'm excited that you've watched it.
Well, my mum loves Hard Quiz, and usually when my mum loves something, you know, the law of the universe is that I would hate it. But it's one of the few things that we can unite on and actually bond over.
Yeah,
so thank you, Tom.
Oh, no worries.
For making an afternoon with my mother that much more tolerable.
Yeah, it's a cynicism that brings generations together.
Yeah, my mum loves it as well. Like, I get a text every week about everything that's made her laugh and what she thinks of certain guests. And mate, you've got the mums and you've got a broad range of people watching it.
Well, on Instagram today, someone sent me a video of a school who had done Hard Quiz at their assembly, and they're all
really
a primary school, not a high school.
I want to see the kid who's doing you.
Oh, he ran out flapping his arms like he was flying. I don't actually do that, but I was really impressed. He was came out.
And did he bring the venom?
Yep.
Yeah, great.
And yeah, they all and they, but also the kids who are the contestants. There was, I forget the first kid's name, but let's just say it was Tanya, and her expert subject was hygiene. So like that. So all their subjects seemed to be little digs at the kids who were the contestants, and
that's really
funny. They had all the banners up, and
that's
they had the podiums, and yeah, it's
so
crazy.
So is this the first time, and that you may have even thought of, that you may have thought of this before, but is this the first time now that you suddenly realize that in about 10 years time, 12 years time, you might be performing with people who are saying, I got into hosting quizzes because of you?
I can't go to pub trivia ever again, because I'll be like, oh, this is why I started.
Can I say that's actually happened to me in the most confronting way?
Yeah.
In the early 2000s, I used to write kids' game shows.
Oh, really?
Go, Go, Stop.
Yes.
It's Academic. Shows like this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And if you watch those shows season by season, you can chart the state of my mental health by the quality of the questions and what they're about. Suddenly we're doing questions about tree consciousness. I wonder what he's on. Yeah. But I was about 5 years ago flirting with a very attractive young lady, and it came out that I used to write Go, Go, Stop, and she goes, oh my God, I used to watch that when I was growing up. That's so cool. And wow. I never felt so fucking aged out and inappropriate in that situation.
Wow.
Really. Well, my weird one now is Skit House. So people who were teenagers or in primary school when that came out 20 years ago say, oh, I loved you on Skit. That was the best show ever. You right. should do that again. And it's like, well, it's not the best show ever.
Yeah.
It was good. You know, you should do it again. It's like, they're like, why don't you do it again? And they love the show, and I don't quite have the heart to say to them, because I wasn't paid very much.
Yeah.
It took ages.
Yeah.
And sticking a moustache on is fucking annoying.
Yeah. And guess what? Like, I hate to say this, I've moved on.
Yeah.
It was 20 years ago.
An episode of Hard Quiz takes 45 minutes to shoot.
Yeah.
One Australian fast bowler sketch would take 3 hours, and it would come out at a minute and a half.
Right.
I'm sorry, it's just, it's the ratio for me.
It's
all about the airtime.
Yeah. Would you ever bring back the Australian fast bowler?
No.
Not at all?
Oh, bro.
Do you know what I learned?
As a live show?
It's the fucking age of the reboot. You could bring it back to millions of dollars.
This could be a movie.
Like you ran into
Netflix TV series.
I ran into the makeup artist who used to get me done up for the Australian fast bowler recently, and it was so annoying. We were just chatting, just had ran into her. Her name's Monica. She's great. And we were talking about how annoying it was that every time I'd have this chest hair glued on that was black, so I had black chest hair to look like Dennis Lilly, and how it was her spirit gum, and I had to tear it off.
Oh.
And she was like, yeah, it used to be really painful because you had chest hair. And I'm like, yeah. And then she looked at me and she said, we should have just dyed your chest hair black. And I'm like, why the fuck are you telling me this 20 years after the fact?
Amazing.
Because I could have dyed my chest hair black and never had to glue it on ever.
And felt really good about
and
yourself.
It would have been like, fine. No one would see it.
But also having a shower, catching yourself in the mirror. Look at that chest hair. Yeah. That feels nice.
Because I've got quite a hairy chest, but it's red. But I could have just dyed it black.
Anyway. Wow. That is hilarious.
There's been a lot of advancements in makeup technology over the last 20 years.
That's so good.
Oh,
so I have 5 random questions that I've written for you.
Lovely.
And there's one I'm really excited about, but I'm going to save it for a second. I'm going to give us a warm-up one.
Okay.
All right. Tell me something that you once loved, but you no longer love, that you're no longer into.
Oh, I've got a good one.
Great.
Absolutely love the Go-Betweens.
Right.
They're one of my favourite bands.
Oh, right.
And just because I just thought, wow, this is a band that's artistic and lyrical and proudly Australian. And also Grant McClellan was from, the country.
Yeah.
Talked about being on a farm. I grew up on a farm, loved it. And as a kid, I thought this is the best thing ever. And then a year ago, I started listening to a band called Television from New York, who predate them by 5 years. And they sound exactly the fucking same. And I've been living with thinking that Robert Forster was a genius for 20 years. And I didn't know that he basically ripped off Television wholesale.
Oh,
the
no.
guitars, the voice, the lyrics, the whole thing. You know how there's a Go-Between bridge in Brisbane? It should be called the Television fucking bridge. Because Television... The good news is now I love Television.
Right.
They're a great band. But you can't listen to the Go-Betweens again.
Is it that full on?
I'm so dumb. I was thinking Sonic Youth were influenced by the Go-Betweens because they had dissonant guitars. And now I realise that no, Sonic Youth listened to Television because they are also from New York, you fucking idiots.
So,
Is it that much of a rip-off or is it more homage?
Well, you could call it an
homage. Legitimate, right?
It is an homage, and they're definitely influenced by them. But I thought that they were really, really original.
Yes, yes, yes.
And they're nowhere near as original as I thought. in their early incarnation.
That's devastating. That happens in comedy all the time.
And now Lindy Morrison, the drummer, is doing ads for fucking Apia.
Right.
Wait, what's Apia?
Australian Pensioners Insurance Agency. The drummer is doing ads for Australian Pensioners Insurance Agency. I'm fucking dead. They're dead to me.
Oh, man.
I'm gonna delete them from my Apple Music file.
Wow.
I don't have one.
No. Maybe you'll get one.
I'm going to get my CDs back from the Vinnie DePaul that I handed them all into and then get them back out and smash them.
Right. Wow.
Do a big CD burning.
What a sweet turn. I was expecting that. That was a warm-up question. Yeah. It's coming hot.
All right.
I love that, though. Mm. How far through... So, hang on. How did you hear television? Were you just... Like, did you just... Going through old albums, old bands, thinking, oh, I've never listened to them. Because that's what I did with Roxy Music last year. I was like, yeah. I kind of know some of their songs, but I don't know them. Gave it a hard listen.
There was a book called, I think it's called 1973.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just about all the music that was released in that year, I think. I'm pretty sure I've got the year right.
Yeah.
And it talks about how basically that was a music crossroads. There's also a doco now on Apple TV called 1971. Same thing. They're just saying that it was a crossroads when everything changed and television was given heavy praise. And I'm like, I have not heard any of their stuff. And I listened to their... They released two albums in the 70s, and I'm like, oh, my God. I am an idiot. I've been hoodwinked by Robert Forster and Grant McLellan.
So they should be the go-betweens, the television down-under experience. And then you'll bring you back from the edge.
Yeah.
Have you had that?
No, they'd be called Idiot Box, wouldn't they? Idiot Box, the Australian television show.
Have you had that with a band or an artist?
I came to music like quite. I wasn't a music listener when I was a teenager.
Oh, really?
No, because I grew up in the Northern Beaches of Sydney, so everyone was into Nirvana and Pearl Jam, which just didn't speak to me.
Yeah,
I liked musicals and novelty songs from The Simpsons and Animaniacs. That was like what I thought music was. And you know the Yakko Warner world travel song where he sings all of the countries in the world in 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
I love the lyrical complexity of that kind of stuff, but like rock music just didn't do it for me. And then anytime I turned the radio on, it was Mumbo Number 5 or the Goo Goo Dolls or whatever. So in my mind, music was bad. And then when I was about 20, I had a friend who started, you know, he gave me Radiohead, he gave me Frank Zappa, Modest Mouse, a whole bunch of that stuff. So my music knowledge is not dense enough to feel betrayed by the homage.
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a lot of the time when I have that with film. Like, I'll see a film and go, wow, what an original thing. And then I'll realize, oh, no, you just literally ripped off a Hitchcock movie. Like, I saw a lot of Brian De Palma films as a teenager. And then you go back and you're like, oh, my God, it's shot for shot Hitchcock.
Yeah.
I think homage in film is maybe more acceptable.
Right.
Like that kind of we're building on a legacy and that kind of stuff.
We're building on the foundations of... But that's kind of what happens in music as well. Like, you know, it's tricky, isn't it? Because once upon a time, it's like, oh, we're going to take that... That bass line, like what is it that the Beatles got done for Come Together, which was, it had a lyric that was similar to a Chuck Berry song, and they had to put Chuck Berry in as a co-writer because of it, you know. So, and then in recent times, it was Blurred Lines, where they just thought they were sampling a part of a Marvin Gaye song, and then the Marvin Gaye estate has come in and gone, no, we're going to take half your royalties. Thank you very much. So it's tricky in music, isn't it?
Mm.
Like you never see a director suing another director for having the same shot.
But it depends. For me, it's if you've had your mind blown. So you mentioned Nirvana, and I was already into Sonic Youth when Nirvana came out, and the bass player wore a Sonic Youth t-shirt.
Yep.
So when everyone was having their mind blown by Nirvana... My mind had already been blown. So it's like, no, that's just a bit of an... That's more of a pop improvement on Sonic Youth. Like, it's been done. Don't worry about it. And I'd already listened to Mudhoney and all that other grunge stuff. So for me, it's more... There's nothing wrong with the homage, but it would be like me... Like, imagine if I'd enjoyed Nirvana all this time and then discovered Sonic Youth this year.
Yeah.
I'd be like, what? Yeah. That was there all along.
But do you think that you would get into Sonic Youth, or you'd just be like, oh, yeah, that was the soil that Nirvana came out of, and that's okay because everything influences everything?
Well, it depends. If I'd embraced it like as... a core part of my identity.
You're right. It's the mind-blowing thing.
Yes.
That's what it is.
That's right, yeah. Go Betweens made me start a band. Like, that's how close they were to my heart.
Yeah.
And now I hate them.
Yeah. Coming in hot. I love it. Sometimes the homages can ruin the original thing that they're homaging.
The Simpsons did that for me.
Well,
that's because I like The Simpsons was my text as a teenager, probably from 8 to 18.
Yeah.
So those first 6 or 7 seasons that I've rewatched recently and are still unimpeachable. Mm. So brilliant. But that's how I came to most of my pop culture and political knowledge, was through Mad Magazine or The Simpsons. So, because it was this, I had a moment when I was 8 years old when I'd watched, maybe you guys don't remember it, it's the King Kong episode, and Mr. Burns is talking about getting Marge on a boat.
Yes.
And Smithers goes, I don't know, as far as I'm concerned, women and semen don't mix. And I remember having seen, it was like the 5th or 6th time I'd seen the episode, and then 8 years old going, oh my God. And it was this moment of, well, if I didn't get that reference or that joke, what else am I not understanding? So it became this very, like very directed thing to try and figure out what all the references were. So yeah, basically every movie I watched subsequent to that, Clockwork Orange, Citizen Kane, was through the filter of Simpsons.
Right.
Yeah. So it was, nothing was ever new. It was always part of a pastiche or an homage.
Did it ruin it though? Or did maybe sometimes?
Yeah, occasionally, yeah. Like, yeah, twists, you know, like I could never watch Planet of the Apes without knowing that, yes, they're on Earth, you know, yeah, because of the Troy McClure musical in The Simpsons.
Yeah.
But, you know, like other things, sometimes it'd be an Easter egg.
Yes.
Sometimes you would watch something and there's an episode where Bart's reaching for 2 cupcakes, yeah, and his eyes are rolling in the back of his head, and that's, yeah, a reference to Alex from A Clockwork Orange reaching for 2 tits. Yeah. So, yeah, when I saw that for the first time, it was more like an Easter egg. Pop culture Easter egg.
Well, this is going to blow your mind because I'm just a little bit older than you. Yeah. I just understood the references.
That would have been nice.
And it was so much more satisfying, yeah, I think. Because I would watch it and I'd laugh and I'd go, that reminds me of Clockwork, yeah, Orange.
Not have to spend your entire childhood digging through, yeah, the refuse of pop culture. Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, I think I was 18, I think, when it started. Is that right?
No.
Is that right?
No.
We're adults when Simpsons started.
It started in 89.
Yeah. I was in year 10 in 1989.
It started around it was when Channel 10 was cool. And it had...
Remember Seinfeld?
Yeah, but I think it was 91 when it actually started being on free-to-air. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
Seinfeld. But yeah, by then I was at uni, so...
Yeah. I find it really hard to watch Pulp Fiction because that style was, you know, like the style and the format of the movie,
yeah,
was suddenly, you know, pretty much the same kind of style that was used in every indie movie from early to mid-90s. Yeah. And then when I watch it now, it's like, oh, this is a bit slow, and I've seen all of this. But I remember when I first saw it, how much I loved it because I hadn't seen that before.
Yeah, it felt quick.
Yeah.
I think I was... Yeah, there's like John Travolta walks down a corridor and then turns left and leaves through a door. And it's like, that took ages.
Yeah.
Like, by modern film standards.
That'd be Paul Greengrass, yeah, shaky, yeah, yeah, cat. Yeah, 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 yeah. I had that with Snatch recently. I hadn't seen Snatch in 20 years, and I loved that movie as a 18-year-old.
Yeah.
And it is unfucking watchable. It's, yeah, unwatchable. Every line, it's, you know, and it's that very stylized form of delivery, which at the time was really cool, whereas now it's so affected, and it's like, ah, please stop trying to be cool and hardcore.
And it'd, yeah, been mimicked by 1,000 commercials. And,
yeah, yeah. And I think, in the cultural zeitgeist, what Guy Ritchie became. So, you know, it's, yeah, hard to watch stuff in a vacuum anymore.
I've been working with someone recently who told me that Guy Ritchie threatened to beat him up at a awards show, and was because he'd made a joke about Madonna and he was going to beat him up, and he had to keep on the move throughout, yeah, right, this awards show because Guy Ritchie was going to fucking job him.
And he would have done it like that as well. You know, I'm going to fucking job you. Jesus.
The reason I asked was last night I got home and I was pretty tired, and you know when you're just kind of channel flicking and then you see a movie that you always love, yeah, but you haven't watched for a long time,
yeah,
and then you start watching it and you go, Jesus, this has not aged well. And that was From Dusk Till Dawn. Which was kind of like, I always enjoyed it as a fun film. I didn't think anything more of it, and it was kind of the first film that Clooney did after ER, which was like, oh, look, he can be in a film. And funnily enough, it's Quentin Tarantino's performance, which is
dog shit.
Oh, like, you're talking it up. It's awful. And it's just so bad. Yeah. And it's
he's
just,
always terrible.
Yeah, but it's particularly because he's being cool. Like, at least in, like, he's not cool in Reservoir Dogs. Like, his character's not cool. And he's not cool in Pulp Fiction, but he's kind of like, even though he's the lesser brother who's a little bit creepy and everything, like, standing next to Clooney, you're watching him going, like, he's even kind of got the similar haircut, and you're going, what is happening with that head?
Why did 90s and early 2000s cool age so poorly, but 1940s and 50s cool is still fucking cool?
Well, it might not have been. Like, maybe 40s and 50s cool wasn't cool in the 60s.
Yeah. Sure. Yep.
So,
okay.
And now, you know, maybe in 10 years' time or something, we'll look back at it and go, oh, yeah, no, that's all right. It's back.
Oh, maybe. But, I'm terrified to rewatch stuff like The Matrix. Like,
Matrix is good.
Is it hold up?
Matrix holds up.
They're wearing a lot of leather and the sun.
But it feels... But now, because of... In all honesty, now watching The Matrix, because of superhero movies, it just feels like a costume.
Okay.
Less than a fashion statement.
Right.
Which gets me to my next question for you. Did everyone see... by the way, you are my two favourite people to ask this about, because you're going to be totally into this as a subject. Be furious, but into it. And Tom, you're not going to give a shit. And it's a perfect blend.
What did if it's the reverse?
Well, I just have a feeling.
Okay.
Well, you know, if you want to be contrary, but I know you both well. How much of the controversy this week on social media did you follow about Batman going down on Catwoman? And if you don't know what I'm talking about, here's the photo.
Whoa! He's eating... What? Is that real?
Yeah, so...
Batman's eating Catwoman now.
Yes. Yes.
That's cool.
So there was a... It came out that there was the R-rated Harley Quinn TV episode was going to have Batman go down on Catwoman, and they nixed it because they've got to sell toys and things like that. And so then there was this whole controversy about, you know, whether he would or wouldn't, etc. And then this picture was posted with one word that just said, canon. Would you like to guess, Ben Elwood, who posted that photo? They did not.
It's
that
a photo.
Picture.
It's a drawing.
They didn't draw it. But do you want to know?
Grant Morrison.
No. No. Have a think. Have a think.
Is it a comics person?
No.
I don't know.
Zack Snyder.
Ah. Oh.
See, I feel like you should have.
Yuck. That would be up Zack Snyder's ass. Like, look, I think it's... Did that really cause a controversy that a fictional character that's drawn...
But that's... The controversy was that they didn't allow it to be in the Harley Quinn R-rated cartoon. That's just what he posted, and there's been all this controversy about people talking about whether Batman would go down on Catwoman. And it essentially was one of those things where... I've been out on comics for a while now. Like, I've lost more and more interest over the last few years. I just think they're kind of repeating themselves. I think once you go postmodern on an art form, it's done. Do you know what I mean? There's nowhere else to go. And I just looked at that and went, yeah, that feels about right on where I feel I'm at with. That's an exclamation point on no more, thank you very much.
I think all of these things, it is...
That sounds like you don't like going down on people, though. You're like, that's it, I'm out.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm still into Batman. I'm just not going to go down on women anymore. That's... sorry, I'm out. I'm taking down my site, and anyone who's paid money, I will refund.
I like that you said, did you follow the commentary on Twitter? And at that point, I was going to go, no.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I know.
No, I read Twitter, but sometimes I'll see... Sometimes when there's some kind of concern, I'm like, I just scroll past it. I get it. Yeah, they're going to try to... I can see what this is about. Yeah.
Isn't it just a bunch, like... Because there was a controversy, whatever. I don't know what constitutes that word now. But... Wasn't there a comic a couple of years ago where Batman's cock was hanging out?
Yeah.
And everyone freaked out about that.
Yeah, the bat dong.
And I do get it. Like, you know, I love that. I love that stuff, but it is essentially for children.
Yeah.
And I feel like what's happening now is there's a generation of dudes that cannot let go of their fucking things that they loved when they were children.
Yeah.
And so instead of just kind of evolving as human beings and going, that's fine, you can still enjoy Batman, But you, they're trying to inject this like edginess or this raw sexuality into it that's completely incongruent with the source material. Batman doesn't have sex. He's a fucking drawing.
It's the thing that we have talked about before, our favourite writer, Grant Morrison, when someone at a convention said, how does Batman get all the petrol for the Batmobile? He said, he's a drawing. He doesn't need it.
He's made of paper.
It works, mate. What are you worried about?
But this is my fundamental problem with all that Zack Snyder stuff. It's that thing of like, these are, I don't know, it's a bad interpretation of Superman when you can't take a 10-year-old to see the Superman movie.
Yes.
Because Superman's snapping necks and fucking people. It's like, I'm not against sex and violence, but where it's appropriate, right?
Yeah.
Also, Batman going down on Catwoman in costumes. Like, if we changed those costumes and they were furries, we'd all be going, oh, that's a bit much. But also, it brings up the fundamental question, which version of Batman would go down on Catwoman?
1960s.
Yeah. Absolutely.
100%. Adam West.
Thank you.
100%.
Wait, yeah, definitely.
Were there actually people getting into an argument? Because, you know, like when you said the Twitter controversy, I had a similar reaction. I don't follow this. Like, were people getting out? What were they getting outraged about?
Well,
were there incels going, Batman would never eat pussy? That's demeaning.
Well, everything from, you know, it's children's stuff to what are you doing to. Yeah, no, of course he'd go down on her and all that kind of commentary.
Yeah.
And it was just making me laugh. I was actually at the Chase doing work, and then, you know, I'd have little moments and I'd just click back on and read and go, fuck, these people are insane. Like, and it went on for days I could not stop laughing. Yeah. It was the funniest thing I had seen in a long time.
Like, people don't have enough, like, do people not have enough drama in their lives?
No.
Like, I can't imagine caring about anything that much to be spent 4 days typing my fucking opinions on it. It's like,
Yeah, I know. It's just a comic book. It's fine.
Yeah, it'll be okay.
Like, remember when I told you I saw Man of Steel?
Yeah, you said I'm out.
That's a fucked up movie, man.
No, it was, because I really liked Superman when I was a kid. Yeah. The first one with Christopher Reeve, very exciting. And I've been wanting to recreate that feeling. So the Brandon, what's
Routh.
It? Routh. Right. One came out and it wasn't quite right.
No.
So I was a bit disappointed.
Aeroplane scene's good.
Yeah.
Where he catches the plane.
Yeah.
Very good.
And then the, so Man of Steel came out and I was watching it in a cinema in Perth and I really wanted it to be great because I wanted to recapture that moment. And then at the end, I was rather underwhelmed. And then I thought, I think even then I was like 40. I'm like, what am I doing?
What am I doing?
I was in the cinema on my own. I thought, I'm 40. I've got kids.
Yep.
I shouldn't give a shit about this.
Well,
and so then I never watched a superhero film ever again until I could watch them with my kids.
Right.
Yeah, now it makes sense again.
Yeah. He's back from the edge.
But I think what people don't realise with this stuff is a lot of the time it's not the thing. It's the feeling that the thing gives you. And you can continually have that feeling.
Yeah.
You're not going back to the same two-dimensional well over and over again for decades. Like at a certain point, a man dressing up like a bat and like it's at some point, like, exactly, you're 40 and you got kids, and it's like, well, you know, like the story should not be as relevant as you move through life. You should get new stories for whatever phase you're in.
I think you can still enjoy things, but it's when you're, I think the problem is when you start, like, you know, there's a difference between something being operatic and big and full of big set pieces, and it's the same. It's like going to a Bourne movie. Do you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. But when you start bringing in weird shit like that, it's like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing with your time?
Well, especially
when it's at the expense of when we were reading stuff and there was all, like, you know, probably the most influential person in pop culture still at this very point is Alan Moore, and we were reading his stuff like throughout the 80s and 90s, and it's a, you know, he wrote Watchmen, which inspires a limited TV series which gets a law changed in Oklahoma. Like, his stuff is still having this knock-on effect. You know, the Anonymous wears the Guy Fawkes marks from V for Vendetta. I just haven't felt anything like that for such a long time, and I feel like I kept going back to the art form almost out of habit. And then it was like one of the best things that happened during lockdown. I'm the only person in the world who went lockdown. Fuck, give me another one. I made some real progress there. But breaking the ritual of going in on a regular basis made me go, oh, yeah, I haven't been enjoying this for ages.
Yeah. But is that the case with a lot of things, right? I hold on to a lot of bad habits out of a sense of duty.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this is who I am.
But it's even less than that. It's just, that's just what you do.
Yeah.
And it's like, I just don't need to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Question number three. There's been a lot more talk lately of theoretical scientists talking about how we're living in a simulation. If we are, who's running it?
Like an eight-year-old boy, and a sadistic eight-year-old boy just going, tornado, COVID. Just like smashing buttons with his fat little fingers.
You think so?
See what happens. Yeah, when I had The Sims at 15, I tried for about a day to make a nice house for them and realized how fucking boring it was and how much more fun it was to just spread strife and torture them, delete the toilet, watch them plead to God for a toilet as they wet themselves. Like, there was a real... There was a glitch in The Sims where if you built them a pool and then they jumped in and you deleted the ladder, they couldn't get out. So they'd just be swimming, like... And at one point, his wife's, like, streaking up and down the pool, imploring me to help. Like, don't let my husband drown. And I'm there like...
Wow.
And of course he died, and it was much more gratifying than the little green diamond above their head telling me that they were happy and fulfilled.
Wow. That says a lot, Ben.
Says a lot about how powerless I was at the time, yes.
So what was the question again?
If we're living in a simulation, who's running it?
Oh.
What kind of person?
Daryl Summers.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, he's running it. And it's a TV show.
Right.
That he's developed for Summers Carol Production Company.
Amazing.
Yeah, and it's it's a reality show, and we're all actors in it. We don't realise,
and we don't know.
No, in fact, we're just walking around completely oblivious of the fact that we have to send Summers Carol Productions an invoice.
Yeah.
For appearing in this show. It's like Hey Hey It's Saturday, but just like expanded out into the real world. Well, that chaos.
Yeah, that explains how he keeps getting work.
Yeah,
because he's the star.
Yeah.
So I've mentioned it briefly on this podcast, but I did the writing for Dancing with the Stars,
of course,
the writing
of
the scripts. Yes. And the main reason that I said yes was because for years I would go down to Mario's in Melbourne and I would see Red Simons, yes, would just come and sit with me, and he was like pretty good fun. Yeah. And he would just tell you stories, and I would hear all these stories about Daryl. And when I got offered this job, I was like, I don't have any Daryl stories. Does that mean I'm not really in entertainment? So I locked in, and it was the full Daryl experience. Have to say, one-on-one, very gentlemanly, very polite, you know.
Shorter than you think.
Yes, almost magical. Do you know what I mean? Like, almost... almost lick the back of his neck and get some powers, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. His hair is remarkably still pretty luscious. I was envious
Fuck
of that.
Yeah.
He has some great stories, if you believe stories should go forever and not really finish, but and happen at any moment when you're really busy. And it was fascinating because he was saying, like, you're a stand-up comedian. How do you still do comedy? And I was like, well, I just try not to be racist, sexist, or homophobic, or awful.
during the heyday, like when you guys watched
the heyday,
yeah. Did it? Were you like me in that ignorant enough to not feel like it was that bad? I mean, obviously, in retrospect, it is. And seeing certain clips now, it's like, holy shit.
Yeah, but the bad clips that they've got, like, they are, obviously they're bad, and, you know, and everyone's concerned about that.
But
to be fair...
They've got
the access to all the episodes.
Yeah.
And they've... Okay, so there's the blackface, redface incident, and there's the Kamal incident. They're the two big ones.
Yeah.
I can't think of any others.
It feels like it should be the Kamal incidences.
Well, let's say there were five. That show, I'm pretty sure it was live for 2 hours.
Yeah. 30 years.
Like, for 30... Like, that's a lot of footage.
Yeah.
So, if you're trying to be racist, that's a bad hit rate.
Yeah.
You know, you got to hit that mark every week. Week in, week out. Tune in. We'll be racist this Saturday at 6:30 on Channel 9. They didn't fulfil that promise.
No. And that's why I've refused to go back and watch it. Yeah. How am I going to get furious about all this stuff?
I shouldn't be defending Hey Hey It's Saturday, but when you're a kid, I mean, well, it was easy for me to enjoy because I'm white, I guess. But I, it was just the chaos. It was actually, that's what was enjoyable about it.
That's what was fun.
But it's also what makes it not good to rewatch, in the same way that I think that everyone talks about how great Letterman was. But if you watched an old episode of Letterman, you'd probably find it boring, because part of the allure was that it was live and it was about things that had happened that day or yesterday or the day before.
Yeah.
And it, and Hey Hey It's Saturday's the same. I just don't think it stands up. Like, you wouldn't go back and watch a classic episode of Hey Hey It's Saturday, because half of it is just riffing and weirdness.
Yeah. But
in live, it was exciting.
The one of the funniest things I've ever seen was on Hey Hey It's Saturday, and it was, what was the name of the guy who used to sell the used cars? Ken something? Ken?
Oh,
anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Commodore.
So he used to put up
cars.
They'd
always bring him out, yeah.
Yeah.
Ken Morgan.
Ken Morgan.
Yes.
Big hair, you know, runs a car lot. Anyway, someone won the car, and Red and Wilbert drove it out, and it was the car that they were going to give to the person, but as they were driving out, because they were so busy being, you know, idiots and piss-farting about, they dragged the side of it up against all this Perspex and put on this massive dent and ripped all the paint off. And you can see Ken Morgan in that moment going, we're going to have to fix that. Like, what are you doing? And the way they just were like, oh, well, that's happened. And the absolute anarchy of that moment. No, I wouldn't go back and watch it. But in the moment, it was great, because you saw them all reacting as it happened, and it was really funny.
Yeah, and there's nothing really like, because I mean, in comedy rooms, when that kind of energy is in the space, that's my favourite time to be in comedy. That real electric kind of, oh, fuck,
yeah,
this is
bouncing
happening.
Off each other. Yeah.
And it couldn't happen any other way. And if the show was happening 10 minutes later, it wouldn't be happening like this. But there is, there's no real forum for that. No. On TV at
and
all,
it was,
really.
And it was chaos, and it was kind of daggy fun, and invariably you watched it because of the guests, like, you know, and at that age when you were young, you know what I want to see, weirdly, John Farnham and Tom Jones sing a song together and riff off each other, and as a kid that was entertaining. That was fun.
Yeah.
But I felt like as it progressed as well, you know, I think, you know, and this happens with lots of things, it just got tired. And I remember, I probably didn't watch, however long it was on, the last third of my viewing of it, it stopped, because it did feel like it started to get more bullying. You know, there were a lot of, you know, Molly's gay kind of jokes at his expense and all that kind of stuff. And I felt like there was a nastiness that creeped in that either I didn't notice when I was younger, or I honestly think wasn't there.
Yeah, but also you had shows like Good News Week, which were relying on the same kind of chaos, and they were just a bit sharper and a bit more current.
That was, by that stage you're into the D-Gen.
Yeah.
You know, the D-Gen are coming along, and it's...
You've got to compare to that. And then it's starting to look dated.
Yeah, and it's Robin Santo, you know, not sticking to script and driving Jane Kennedy Rob Sitch being Imran Khan and not sticking to script and driving Tom Gleisner crazy, you know. So it was that same kind of energy. You also had the big gig by that stage where, you know, you kind of had the cooler, crazier kind of...
And also you had Rob Sitch doing Desmond Tutu in blackface and...
Oh, yeah,
no one seems concerned about that.
Yeah.
Of course, that doesn't come up at all, has it?
No.
No, because people like the show.
Yeah. Australian TV of that period was fucking insane.
Yeah.
Remember Mahatma Mahatmakot on the Footy Show?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Mahatmakot.
Banana Garner.
Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
So I was on Hey Hey It's Saturday. I went on it, and it was weird because it was like walking into something you'd watched as a kid, and like there's Wilbur and Red and whatever. But the funny thing that happened to me was I'd been boasting to Ellie, my wife, that I'd cracked the code on panel shows. And I was telling her the trick on a panel show, because everyone worries you can't get a word in. And I felt like I'd cracked the code. And I said, well, on Good News Week, I'd worked out that if you ask Paul a question, it gets you in. So whenever there was too much chaos and I wanted to say a funny line, I'd say, Paul. And he would say, what, Tom? And then I'd say him a funny line. It got me in. So then when I went and did hands, I'm like, Daryl. And Ellie was just losing her shit at home because she said, you said nothing, and I could just hear you constantly saying Daryl off camera. Because no one was listening to anybody. Daryl.
What was the segment?
I can't remember. It was like It was like some kind of quiz, celebrity head or something right. like that, one of those things. Something right. like that, where there were three of us sitting on stools doing something. Yeah. I can't remember. Yeah.
There was a period when I first started stand-up in Adelaide, pretty much every act that I knew went and did Red Faces. And
yes.
This was early on, and he will not mind me talking about this because he talks about it all the time, but it was, I'd only known Limo for a little while, and then Limo was going to be on, and I was with my friends going, oh, this is this new guy that I've just met and become friends with, funny guy, cool guy, let's watch his spot. And his spot is a disaster. He bombs like a, it is a wasteland. And it was one of those things that when you saw, it was so bad that the next time you saw him, you just had to just bring it up. You just had to bring it. Like, you couldn't pretend that you hadn't seen it. You just had to say, hey, didn't go very well, did it? And he goes, no.
All right. Well, we need to contact Summers Carol Productions.
Yes.
And get the original broadcast tapes. I think they're called Betacam.
Yep.
And they may not be digitized, but they'll certainly be close to high definition if they're broadcast quality. It'll be in 4:3.
Yep.
And we'll upload it to YouTube. Pristine quality, that spot of Limo's.
Oh, yeah.
We've got to get it on YouTube.
I would not be surprised.
Not if a VHS copy, like a nice, you know, something that'll get shared a lot.
You can actually see the trickle of sweat coming down his face.
I would not be surprised if Limo already has it and has already done it. I had him on the podcast recently. Yeah. Did you hear the story about how he had that joke that he was really happy with about, you know, when you turn 100, you get a letter from the Queen, and when you turn 16, you get a text from Prince Andrew. And he was so happy with the joke that he put it on Twitter to timestamp it. And then one of the people, then his wife was watching RuPaul's Drag Race, and one of the performers did that joke, and so he had a bit of back and forth with them, and it was all funny. And it turned out that that person had gotten the line from a friend who'd read it online, and I was like, this is some Christopher Nolan bullshit. You are the reason of your demise with this gag. Yeah. And now he's really upset because they wouldn't air that joke in the UK, and that person's been cancelled, and now Limo's got cancel envy.
He's like, I could have been controversial.
Yeah.
Oh, how annoying.
So anyway, I reckon he does have that clip, and he has put it up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Okay. What are you loving at the moment? Anything, whether it could be TV, movie, music, food.
I'm loving 1950s movies at the moment.
Oh.
Like a total 1950s jag.
What brought that on?
I watched A Streetcar Named Desire. And it was so much more fucked up than I ever imagined it could be.
Had you never seen it before?
No.
Right.
No, I didn't realise how twisted it is.
Yeah.
And I think it's just that thing where...
Can you sum it up for people who haven't seen it?
I don't want to ruin it.
No. I don't mean like...
A Streetcar Named Desire. It's the first movie that Marlon Brando kind of popped in. It's set in New Orleans in the 40s, I think. And he plays Stanley Kowalski, a really abusive but very charismatic drunk, and he's married to a woman whose insane sister comes for a visit.
Yeah.
And I think we're all very much live in the time that we live, and it's really easy to think like, oh, we're kind of the smart version of humanity right now, or we're the leading edge, or the cynicism that exists is only recent. And all of these 50s movies I'm watching are so dark and so cynical about the state of play as it was then. I think it's easy to look back at a period like the 50s and go, you know, maybe everyone was post-war, gee whiz, you know, better living through chemistry, all that kind of stuff. But to go back and see, no, there were hardcore cynics.
Yeah.
Even back then is really eye-opening, which maybe it shouldn't be.
Right.
But yeah, it's been really, really cool. Really good stuff.
And what else have you been watching?
Streetcar Named Desire, a bunch of Billy Wilder movies, Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, I have a real...
Yeah, Billy Wilder's great.
...void with Billy Wilder.
Oh, that's great.
You mentioned Billy Wilder to me, I think, last time we caught up, and it was like, oh, you know what? That is what I need to get
into. There's a movie I watched recently, Kurt Russell, called Ace in the Hole, and it's about a guy who gets stuck in a cave. And Kurt Russell plays a sleazy journalist who's like, this is the story of the year. And the whole movie is this two-hour unfolding of basically this town turning into a circus. All waiting for this guy. Is he going to live? Is he not going to live? And it's this total indictment of the media and sensationalism and journalism and everything. And I guess now, especially, where everyone's kind of in the fake news era and being hyper cynical, to know that no, people 60 years ago were asking these questions, and they were just as, you know, in the fore. It's really good stuff.
Hang on, when's that Kurt Russell movie?
1951.
Oh, not Kurt Russell, it would be Kirk Douglas.
Kirk Douglas.
Yes, that's why I was getting confused. Yeah.
1950s. Yeah, great movies.
Right. What about you, Tom?
I read a biography of Jack Nicholson, which I really enjoyed. It's a trashy biography. It's the same guy who wrote a biography of Steve McQueen. And it's one of those guys, you know, it's the kind of biography where you basically just roll through their life.
Yeah.
And it's full of unsubstantiated quotes. So it's really nice to read. But it's sort of like I didn't know his career in detail. So I've been going back and watching the films that sort of got him to where he was.
Oh, yeah. So what have you watched?
Well, I'd always seen Easy Rider, so I knew about that. Yeah. But then I watched it was probably a magical three in a row. It was the Five Easy Pieces, The Last Detail, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
And Chinatown, sorry, before that one.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's great. It's good just watching him sort of like, it's all there. Even in the first
so
one,
good.
Last Detail, it's all there.
It's so good.
And it's amazing watching it emerge. But also, I had the pleasure of knowing that my wife had never seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh.
And I hadn't watched it since I was a teenager. So that was an extremely satisfying film to watch again.
Can I ask you a question?
Because it was just so good. Yeah.
So when I had a similar thing. I watched it when I was a teenager and Randall was my hero.
Yeah.
And then I watched it a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And I suddenly empathised with Nurse Ratched.
Yes.
Did that happen to you?
Yeah, of course.
All of a sudden you were like, I get it, you know, yeah, fuck the man and fuck authority, but she's just trying to do her fucking job, bro.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I thought it was really interesting that turning point where Nurse Ratched, you're like, when she says she still wants to help him, and you're like, does she? Or not? That's a very good turning point. But my favourite part of the film was when they have a big party and they drink so much that they don't leave.
Yeah.
And it was the perfect time to escape and the window was open. And there's a moment where Jack Nicholson is drunk and you can tell he's almost falling asleep.
Yeah.
And he looks out the window and he looks back at the crowd and you can see him thinking, can I leave these people? I should be leaving now. Am I going to leave? But it's where I realised just how good he was at acting, because my wife and I kept talking about it. I think the camera's on him for about 2 minutes and he says nothing.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's in slow motion, but it's not. Yeah. And you're like, wow. Like, just getting so much information out just by some looks.
That is a crazy year for actors and movies. So, Jack Nicholson, of course, won the Best Actor Award.
Finally got it.
Which he deserved.
And it's considered overdue as well, because he'd been nominated a few times.
What year are we talking?
So, it came out in 75, so it's the 76 Oscars. And
wow, what a run for him. That's crazy. But
Jaws was in there too, wasn't it? Maybe?
Well, the person that he beats is, it's like any other year, this person would have won. No. It's Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon. And that is a spectacular performance. Yeah. And then you've got Nicholson in Cuckoo's Nest. So that year, the movies were Nashville, which is a great film, Jaws, Barry Lyndon,
fucking good.
Dog Day Afternoon and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That's
crazy. And you look at the Best Picture nominees now, it's like,
I used to quite ceremoniously watch all the Best Picture nominees every year, but I've stopped doing that the last couple of years. There's just some where you're like, oh, I can see why this was nominated.
I'm fine.
This one's a bit too worthy.
So you've dipped in and out as a guest on this podcast, but you know this is a pretty positive podcast that likes to celebrate art and entertainment, but where Ben and I draw the line is The Shape of Water, and we fucking hate that film and we refuse to like it.
I draw the line. Absurd.
But normally when we draw the line on something, we're still looking for, like, we found some positive things to say about Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Yeah, sure.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But we refuse. We have drawn the line on that film, and it is...
All the Best Picture nominees now, it's like you can see the machine and the industry of the Academy grasping for relevance, and that's why there's very few courageous choices. I feel like the last courageous choice was like Mad Max Fury Road for Best Picture, and maybe I'm true traditionalist, but even there's a part of my head that's like, is it though? Like, it's very good, but is it Best Picture. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, you know, so...
Did Parasite win Best Picture?
Yes.
I thought that was very worthy and a bold choice because it was a foreign film.
Choice, you're right. Yeah.
So, but the...
And a great film.
The thing that ruined the Oscars for me was I used to love it. I used to... Mum and I used to watch it all the time and it was just fun. You know, you'd be rooting for someone, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it was the year... It wasn't the year that Shakespeare in Love won. It was discovering how it won.
Yeah.
And because it ended up beating Saving Private Ryan, and it was the machinations behind the scenes of the, you know, going in and throwing parties and all of that kind of stuff that got him the win. And that's when that was actually the moment that I turned off from awards in general, because it's like, oh, rarely, like I was pretty naive up until that point, but I did sort of think it was on merit, even if you did give an Oscar to someone who maybe didn't deserve it for that, but, you know, maybe they'd been pipped at the post a few times, and then you just go, oh, no, it's all political bullshit.
And like celebrities doing ads where they used to, you know, go to Japan so they wouldn't be seen in the mainstream, now it's just like, no, that's the way you do it. The courting the Academy voters is just part of the thing now. Mm. They talk about it openly.
Yeah.
Like when Leo won his one, he was talking about all the parties that he had to go to Gladhand. And at that point, it's like, well, you're not even winning an award for being a great actor. You're just winning an award for having a great press agent or whatever it is.
Being like a good hang.
Yeah, it's not...
I don't know. I kind of get it, though, because it's like it's industry voted, and so they're just trying to influence the opinions of the industry.
Yeah.
And so, but also, to give you another insight into it, I'm a member of the Actors in Australia, AACTA, because I've been nominated in the past, I get to vote on who wins awards.
Mm.
You know what the frightening thing is? You don't give a shit.
Yeah.
So I vote because I think, oh, you know, the number of times I've sat at home and watched the Oscars and think this person should win, this person was outdone.
Yeah, yeah.
But when it really comes to the crunch, I go down to vote and I'm like, I can't be fucked watching these Australian films.
Yeah.
So I just vote for fucking Red Dog or whatever.
Yeah. So...
It's like, because it's too many.
The person made me feel good.
There's one point where I looked at all the voting and I tallied it up. I was like, I would have to watch something like 20 hours of footage to vote ethically. And I'm like, I'm just not doing that.
Yeah.
You're
not saying anything that's a surprise to me now, but back then I did think everyone was going to watch things. Like, I was naive enough for a long time that, you know, the TV show that got the Emmy for Best Show, that I was like, man, how do they have time to watch all of those shows?
And then you go,
oh, no, they watch one episode, and that's why there's always, in a season, there was always one episode. The Emmy episode, you know? Yes. And then
you submit one.
Then if there's a whole series where it's all intricate and refers back on itself, there's nothing for you to be able to show, because I go, I don't know what's going on here. This isn't very good. By the way, just out of interest, I went to the previous year's Oscars as well, because it was such a good year.
Right.
And the movies nominated were The Towering Inferno.
Oy.
So that's interesting.
That's not really award-worthy, is it?
Well, you know, like it's...
That seems like a glass for relevance nomination.
It's fun.
Towering Inferno was a big hit.
Yeah, well, they had Steve McQueen and Paul Newman in this, and they couldn't decide to put who higher on the marquee, so I think whoever's name was higher was to the right.
Right,
and whoever's name was lower was to the left.
Yeah, good times.
So important. I think Steve McQueen was to the left and low, and Paul Newman was to the right and high.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what happened.
No one's got top billing.
No, nobody get upset. But Lenny...
Lenny's a great film.
The Conversation.
Yeah.
Chinatown. Great. Oh, Conversation's great.
Yeah.
I've only seen it. I had the wrong eyes for it.
Oh, Chinatown's great.
Why is Chinatown so fucking good?
I don't know. It's just better than
so
I remember.
Good.
I think it's just that when you watch it, it feels really, really... You know, I can tell it's 70s Hollywood getting off on making a period film of the 30s or whenever it's set.
And subverting the genre as well.
But the weird thing is, when you watch an old film... that's about old days, it makes it feel more real.
Mm.
Yes. So it makes it feel like, oh, well, this was definitely shot in the 30s.
Yeah.
In beautiful Panavision.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, colour.
But the movie that comes in and takes it all is Godfather Part 2. Like, what a good year.
Yeah.
But how's this so Best Actor. You have Albert Finney on Murder on the Orient Express. I don't know. I can't comment on that. Dustin Hoffman as Lenny. Jack Nicholson in Chinatown. Al Pacino in The Godfather Part 2. Now, that's, for me, that's the movie that he deserves the Oscar for.
Yeah. Because he doesn't get it, does he?
Nah. It's Art Carney in No, it's Art Carney in Harry and Tonto.
What's Harry and Tonto?
No, but there's a theory what happened that year. I know the theory because it was in the book that I read about Jack Nicholson. The vote was split.
Between between Nicholson and Pacino, and so he's done a Steve Bradbury.
Yeah, because it splits for all the people that are big fans of the new Hollywood. They get split,
right.
And so then he sails through. As,
right,
yeah.
Right.
So he's done a Scott Morrison's probably a closer. I close that analogy.
I feel better with Steve Bradbury. Thank you very much.
Do you have a favorite or a couple of favorite films, Tom?
What films do I find watching over and over again? That's the real question, isn't it?
What is ones that like changed your
Apocalypse
your
Now is such an obvious one, but I always watch it over and over again.
Have you seen the new Coppola cut of it that came out a year or two ago?
I've only seen Redux. I didn't really like Redux. I thought that there were some bits that added to it big time, like the whole French plantation scene was just amazing.
Yeah.
And it's so great and beautifully shot.
Yeah.
But then there was another thing where they ended up actually hooking up with the Playboy bunnies, and it was just a bit languid.
That's out of the new cut.
Ah.
You got to see the new cut.
And they're in the rain, and it's just sort of, it takes a long time.
They keep a part of that scene.
Oh, yeah.
But
I should see the new cut.
It is out of control. It's more psychedelic than the previous versions.
So there's Redux. So what's this one called?
The Final Cut.
Final Cut. But so this one's shorter.
Marginally. It keeps the French plantation scene, which I personally don't like because I feel like it's a bit of a stopgap, but whatever. But it streamlines the fat from Redux.
Yeah.
It is... I went and saw it front row at the Orpheum a couple of years ago, and it was one of those like religious experiences.
Yeah.
You love watching movies, but it's rare to sit there for 2.5 hours and not think about anything else other than this experience. And it was just... unbelievable.
Sorry, where'd you see it?
At the Orpheum.
Great. That's what I thought. That's what you said.
One of my favourite director's cuts things is, and I'm sure I've told you this before, is Peter Weir's director's cut of Picnic at Hanging Rock was shorter than the original.
Oh, right.
I think he's the only director who had the discipline to go, okay, I finally get my own cut.
Yeah.
It's got to be shorter.
Yeah. Everyone else is stuffing in a whole lot of things that you're just going, I don't need any of this. Yeah. You know, sometimes constriction is a good thing.
Totally.
Yep.
You know?
Well, speaking of Apocalypse Now, that's why so much of it is so brilliant. It was the restrictions of, you know, like the famous story about Brando turning up to set obese, not learning his lines. And that's why he's shot in those weird shadows, just mumbling about snails crawling on razor blades. And it's so much better than if he'd been ripped and, you know, oh, I'm here in the jungle with my army. It makes it so much more surreal. And
that's exactly how they would do it now as well. Yeah. So maybe this is the answer, but what would be the movie that you'd be angriest about if they remade?
One of those ones.
Imagine if they made Apocalypse Now,
but with all CG.
No. But they turned it into a series on Stan.
With Chris Pratt.
Bro, those series, I can't handle
Chris
them.
Chris Pratt as Marlowe.
They did Catch 22 like that. They turned it into a prestige series.
I know, that was Clooney.
Oh, did they?
Oh, yeah. Dude. And speaking of stuff I haven't revisited, but you know, that book meant a lot to me. And I tried watching the series, and it's like beat for beat for beat the book, and I don't need it in my fucking life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah.
Don't need CG planes.
Just leave it, mate.
Just leave it. It's good as a book.
Just leave it. 2001, maybe add some lasers. Yeah. That'd be good.
Yeah.
Add some lasers, some lightsabers. All right.
Well, just one more thing about reneging on a cut. You know when Lucas was doing all the special editions for Star Wars?
Yeah.
Spielberg jumped on board temporarily and redid E.T.
Yes.
With a CG E.T.
Yes.
And I don't know if
it wasn't a CG. Oh, sorry. No, sorry, go on.
Yeah, it was a full CG E.T.
Was it?
He replaced the puppet wholesale, and it was just this gross CG creation that is clearly CG and all the too expressive, all the rest. And he, after a few years, withdrew it and apologized.
Ah, so I know that exact story.
I like to think Steven Spielberg would have a special login to Netflix and things like that, and he could just delete and change films he likes. Like, you just drag and click them like files.
Yeah.
Like Word documents. It's like, blip, that's gone.
I'm happy for him to have that power as well. I feel like he'd do the right thing. So I know that exact story, but not CGI E.T. I was under the impression that what he did was, because of all the gun violence in America, he took the guns out and he put the
walkie-talkies,
and then he realised... no, you have to put the guns in, and he put the guns back.
Yeah, no, he just got rid of that kind of... Because there's all sorts of things he changed. There's a line where the mother says, you look like a terrorist.
Right.
And it was post-9/11, so it was like, we can't have the word terrorist in E.T., so that was taken out. And...
Yeah. Thank goodness. I rewatched that a few years ago now, but after that cut had been... And it's a perfect film.
Mm. Yeah.
It's E.T.'s a perfect film.
Yep.
So I was rewatching Home Alone recently with my kids, and it's great.
It's great.
It's very, very funny. Like the last sequence when they just it's great.
Yeah.
But there was a line in it which was just so funny. The kids are watching and they're laughing, having a great time. And I think it's Marv when Corley McCulkin's character goes across the flying fox into his treehouse. They go out and they can't find him, and Marv looks down at the ground and goes, "Maybe he committed suicide." And I'm like, you wouldn't have that in a kid's film now. And my daughter said, "What's suicide, Dad?" And I'm like, "Ah, don't worry about it." She's like, "Okay." I should work for Lifeline. Yeah. "What's suicide?" "Don't worry about it." "Okay."
Can I just point out you called Macaulay Culkin Corley McCulkin?
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Big fan.
Corley McCulkin.
He was too busy hoping to get to his line.
Yeah. Corley McCulkin.
Corley McCulkin.
I like his brother, Mr. McCulkin, in Succession.
All right. Last question. What would be your perfect job for whatever comes up next? What would be the perfect thing that you would like to work on? Originally the question was going to be, what's your perfect job? And I have a feeling you'd say, I've already got it.
I was thinking that.
Yeah, so I thought that's why I threw in the next.
Oh, right, yeah. That's a really good question. I don't know. I've lost all ambition.
Right.
Is that because of success?
Yeah.
Really?
I'm not joking. I had a call about 2 years ago from my manager saying, they said, just to let you know, we've been talking to HarperCollins, and if you've got any idea for a book, I'd love to have you write it. And I went, cool. And then I hung up, and then I sat down in my lounge room for an hour, and then I rang back my manager and said, I don't have an idea for a book, sorry.
Amazing. And this is the second time you've thought of it 2 years later.
Yeah. Is it just a thing where you're like, I could host Hard Quiz till the end of my life, and that's fine?
Yeah. It's such a satisfying show to do, because you've got four new people every episode who you get to ad lib with. So it's infinitely fascinating, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Every time you get another four people in front of you, you're like, where's this going to go? It always feels comedically satisfying.
Yeah.
We've done, I don't know what it is now, seven series, and I don't feel like it's ever repeated. And also, they always say things I don't expect, so... You know, whereas, you know, if you're on Spicks and Specs, you can kind of guess what comedians are going to say.
Yeah.
And you sort of, I know where this story's going.
Yeah.
Whereas contestants, you're just like, what the fuck was that about every time?
How early into filming it did the contestants start coming in with... Because I remember you saying to me, there was a point where... You know, you'd be hanging shit on contestants, and then one day they just started fucking coming in prepared, and it really kind of upped the show. It upped the ante. Do you know what season it was, or where in the season?
Well, the first season was only 10 episodes, and we viewed them as 10 pilots. And the whole purpose of the first season was to get renewed. But at the same time, I was definitely going to go... I was going to push all the contestants... I was going to completely flatten them, because I really wanted to... I wanted it to be noticed.
Yeah.
I didn't want the show to be, it's just another comfortable ABC quiz. And in the very first episode, I remember steamrolling a contestant and going too far, and everyone was saying, oh, geez, going too far. But I knew that kind of controversy would make it get talked about, so it was worth it.
Yeah.
Like, ends justify the means. But the whole first series, the whole first 10 episodes, they were all recorded before it was aired.
Right.
And what I didn't realise was, I was very visible on the ABC already, but there are people who just like quizzes. So some of those contestants had no idea who I was. And we were very open in our auditioning process. You know, it was like, it's hosted by Tom Gleason. You might have seen him in Hard Chat. So it was all very open. But there are just some people who want to go on quiz shows and don't scrutinise what they're going on. So some people were surprised. But the other thing that was weird was, because it hadn't gone to air, I'd made up the idea that at the end they get to say the catchphrase, you get the mug, and you get to do the sign-off, and they go, thanks for playing Hard. And I liked it because it suggested that they had watched the show and they'd enjoyed the show so much that they couldn't wait to say the catchphrase.
Right.
But I had to explain it to them 10 times in a row because it hadn't been to air yet.
Right.
So they all go, thanks for playing hard. So in the whole first series, they kept on saying, what do I say again? I'm like, you have to say thanks for playing hard. Okay, thanks for playing hard. No, you've got to say thanks for playing hard like this. Yeah. Okay. That's
yes.
So you have to do it over and over again. So that all went to air. And then the second season came on, and once people had seen it, they all came in prepared.
So
locked and loaded.
So do you have you had people on the show that essentially want to just talk to you and aren't very good at quizzes?
We've had a few people who, well, they have to be to a certain standard to get on.
Yes.
Because they've got to go through a bit of a process.
But it's not the passion.
Oh, yeah. Some people, when I booted them out, have gone, fuck it, I've been on TV. Like they could have just been in the Big Brother house. They didn't care.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of that.
But also the fact that there's no prize money.
Yes.
I mean, you're automatically getting a group of people who are just in it for the fun of it.
Well, it's a panel show for amateurs is how I describe it, yeah. But the other trick I do, and you would get this as comedians, but in general people don't notice, is I often leave the goal wide open for people to kick a goal.
Yeah.
So I'll often, you know, ask, I just mention something about hair.
Hmm.
They're going to pay me out for being bald.
Yeah.
Like I'm leaving it wide open for them. People, they got you a good one. And I'm like, I fucking pretty much put the ball very high on the tee, handed them the wood, and then leant into the fucking golf ball.
Yeah.
That's what I did, but you may not have noticed that.
Yeah.
But it has to be. It has to be. Because if you're not taking it every so often, then you don't. You become the bully, and you don't have that free reign.
Well, it gives the show texture as well. The thing that I learned from watching Jon Stewart host The Daily Show was that when he was down the barrel, or when he was interviewing people, it was his show. But every one of his, in inverted commas, correspondents were all having goes at how old he was, and he would play lower status, and they were treating him like, you know, Colbert would come in, and it was Colbert's show, you know, and John's trying to hold up, and that meant that, you know, you're watching it four nights a week, and it's never boring because the dynamic is changing from segment to segment.
Yeah, and I think we copied that to some degree on The Weekly. When Kitty and I did The Weekly, and Judith as well, we used to always bag Charlie because it just evened it out. You know, if he was going to do a monologue telling you how things were about a particular subject and it was going to be insightful and clever, you can only handle that for so long. So that's why I'd come on and just constantly tear strips off him.
Yeah.
But I think it's acceptable. I really believe it gives the host or whatever in any position like that. It actually gives the host more power.
Yeah.
Like the comfort in being bagged out or the comfort in being vulnerable is actually giving the audience the subconscious impression of this is a very confident person that can, you know, flip between the two.
Yeah. It's funny. You ended up, so I'm working on The Chase. I work with the chasers, and I keep them focused throughout the day, and then workshop lines with them, and each one's different, you know. So like Matt Parkinson, you know, he's been a comedian for decades and is a fucking great guy. And invariably he has his own jokes, and you try to massage them. There was one day behind the scenes, the thing that she talked about was essentially, all she really talked about was her love of 1940s movies. And so you've got a couple of minutes to quickly come up with a joke that's generic, that fits his persona of Goliath, and that's going to be something that people at home who aren't really paying attention are going to get immediately, you know. And it was really exciting because we were both stumped, and I could see his eyes light up like, we've got to work this out. And we were just going back and forth, just saying, you know, oh, well, what about movies, black and white, blah, 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 blah. And then finally we came up with Goliath coming out and saying, you know, since you love 1940s movies, you know, you're the victim tied to the train tracks and I'm the locomotive coming to crush you. And we were like, we came up with that line. And it was almost like this, you know, it was this really exciting moment to be working like that. But it was funny. We have a new host in Larry Emder, who, you know, Larry is just a delight, like a delightful man. And he's just trying to, you know, there's a lot of moving parts and he's trying to get his head around it and all this kind of stuff. And he's really warming into it, doing a great job.
Yeah, getting to know a quiz show when you're hosting it is really difficult. But once you know the ins and outs, it becomes a lot of fun.
And he's doing a really good job. He did it really quickly, but, you know, early on, I didn't throw too many jokes his way because I didn't want to kind of throw him from anything that was going on. But the moment that I knew he was really warming into it was we had a contestant on who was talking about her love of quizzes, and she's been on other quizzes, and she said she'd been on Hard Chat, and he said, which one's your favourite? And she said Hard Chat. So Larry was like, oh, here we go, you know, started reacting to it. And then I don't know what the fucking odds are, but one of the questions was, who's the host of Hard Chat? And she and she was just like, Tom Gleason! And he was reacting off it. And it was so entertaining. It was actually from that moment on I've started writing jokes for the Chasers where they're directing them at him, you know, just creating a dynamic. Like we've had the governess over from the UK who's so stern and doesn't crack a smile or anything. But we've just started throwing in a little not all the time, but now and again, some flirty lines to Larry and watching Larry's ears turn red. Oh, the governess, you know. So it's a fun thing to work on. You created an environment where it's the format is understandable and easy to know, but it's constantly shifting and changing shape with every episode.
But I can get back to your first question, which was, what would you like to do? This is something I'd like to do. I'd love to be a lead in a film and see if I could pull it off. But you can't do that without failing. So like, it'd be good if you could do it to see whether it was good.
What kind of film?
And have the choice of not releasing it.
Oh, yeah, you just want, you know what you need.
I just want to know what it's like to be a lead actor in a film, what it would be like.
But would you go for one of these, like,
Apocalypse Now?
Yeah, like, new, like, unlikely action star movie, or would you go for a dramatic role?
Like a Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah, like Bob Odenkirk
film.
In Mr. Nobody or whatever.
I think there's something interesting about piecing together a performance for camera.
I'd like to see Tom Gleason in a, not this movie, but a movie like Falling Down, where it starts off really fine, everything, and then just watching you deteriorate throughout the course of the day.
Having said that, I did a cameo in Jack Irish, and acting was a bit harder than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
So I've been discouraged a little bit. Right. But I like the idea of... I think it would be a fun thing to do as a challenge, but I'm not convinced I would be... It's worth pursuing.
What did you find difficult about acting?
Being really comfortable with the lines.
Yeah.
Because there's someone else's lines.
Yeah.
And just really simple stuff, just not rushing, you know.
Right.
And also I was performing opposite Guy Pearce, and he knows how to act.
Yeah.
That's unnerving.
And not just knows how to act, but he's really good at it too.
Well, imagine me dragging him down to the Comedy Store and say, you headline tonight and I'm going to support. He'd say, that's a fucking stupid idea. Yeah. And I'd be like, you're right. Well, you should not do that, mate.
Let's do it.
But he let me do that.
Yeah.
It was stupid.
Is it a thing? Because I think comics can be great actors.
Yes.
Because I think...
I'm not convinced I am. Yeah.
But I think we're used to dropping into voices and act out some of that stuff. And I think when you do it on stage, it's so organic and natural that there is a part of your head that's like, oh yeah, I could easily do that on the set.
Of course, I've done so much TV, I feel like I'm piecing together a good performance here, but it's so close to reality, it's not... I think it's a lot, like, I'm aware of where the camera is and I know how to use it to my advantage, but part of me thinks I could maybe use that in acting, but at the same time, I'm in this terrible position where people would say, yeah, you can do it.
Yeah.
You'd be great in one of those slowly unwinding roles, like a Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good.
Or like an Uncut Gems type thing. That'd be where you'd shine.
That would be good.
What about you, Ben?
In terms of work?
Yeah, what would be your dream job if you could do it next?
Probably to, like, work on a farm with dogs and animals and just be in that mode. But that's, like, so outside of the realm of possible. And also, it's like your acting dream where it's, like, there's a part of it that's like, oh, that would be good, but the reality of it would be very different.
Right.
But, you know, I would love to... I've worked as a social worker for years and I'm kind of done with humans.
Yeah.
And so I think next it's got to be animals or back to animals.
Yeah.
You know, I used to work at the zoo and train dogs and that kind of stuff. So
you could still do something, couldn't you? Like, you could still kind of meld those worlds. What we need to do is set you up with some good equipment on a farm. So you got your little sound booth so you can still do podcasts and then, you know, like I was on a work call the other day and Ross Noble was on, and Ross said words that this will sound like porn to you, but Ross at one point said, okay, I gotta go and feed the pigs.
Oh.
And he left his work meeting to go and feed the pigs. Yeah. I had a conversation with him the other day. He was on his tractor.
Yeah.
See, that's lovely. Brendan Burns used to live on a farm.
Right.
I stayed on his farm for a bit, and it was, it seems like a very nice life.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, you know, especially, you know, doing what we do, it's like, you know, I think you have to get to a point in your life where you're like, oh no, I've put all that behind me and now this is my life.
Right. Yeah, you need spare time.
Yeah. My ideal job next would be to work on a really cool HBO TV series, and I'm the person who gets to pick the music that drops at certain points.
At the credit.
And throughout the episode.
Great.
Yeah, and you have to do it like live while they're actually acting, like straight out of your phone.
Yeah. Oh no! I'll sing
like
the song.
Like an annoying person at a party. You've just got like you're on Apple. You're on like Spotify, whatever. Yeah. You're ready, and then they say something, and you just press play.
Yeah.
And every time it's David Bowie.
Look, if I could get the rights, I'll do anything to help out Dad, David. All right. That brings it to an end. Anything to plug, Ben? Do you have anything that you're working on that we can talk about?
I'm working on something
yet?
At the moment, but I can't talk about it yet.
Okay, Tom.
I've got some live shows coming up that I can't talk about yet.
Okay, and I've got some things that I'm working on, and I can't talk about them either. So that's the way to sign off. Thank you to Tom and Ben for joining me today. Did you work out which question bunned me out? Yeah. You picked it. You know you picked it. It was the Batman question. I think Ben was genuinely flabbergasted and angered and just not interested in it. And I think Tom is too much of a grown-up to really want to give it much headspace. The good news is, if you'd like to hear two men be completely childish about the topic, head over to FOFOP, episode 333, where Will and I rate which versions of Batman we think would be the best at giving oral sex. It's the ranking you've been wanting to hear all your lives. And you know what? You're welcome. Actually, you know what? If you have thoughts on which version of Batman would be best, please come over to our private Facebook page, Big Squid with Justin Hamilton. Let me know who you think would be great and why, and maybe we'll make mention of them next week. If you're already a member, that'll be easy. If you're not a member, just send in a request and you're in. It's that easy. Just a little reminder, tomorrow's episode will be The Leftovers, and oh my God, it's such a good episode. It's such a good episode. God, I love it so much. I'm so glad I'm doing this. I can't believe we're right at the end of season two, and then it's only 8 more episodes for season 3, and we're done with The Leftovers. I can't believe we've gotten through it so quickly, the same way I can't believe it's the end of June. Like, what is happening here? I cannot keep up with any of this. If you're enjoying our podcast, please say hello to any of my guests online. Let them know that you're enjoying their work. And if you have time and you would like to give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use, that would be appreciated. Let's finish today with a quote from Adam West. I think it's that wherever I go, people are so nice to me, and they come up by the hundreds and they say nice, funny things. As an actor, I just like to make people happy, make them laugh. That's our job, to entertain. And if I'm entertaining your folks, then I'm happy. Until then.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.